This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Wolves win at Old Trafford for the first time in a generation. A thoroughly professional job against a flat-looking United. Is Bruno Lage in danger of getting spotted by the radar? How come Ralf Rangnick hasn't revolutionised his squad yet? What is he waiting for? Is 4-2-2-2 too wide? Should he perhaps try a 4-1-1-1-1-1-1? Also today, Sid Lowe joins us to answer the question, how can Barcelona afford to buy Ferran Torres? How can Barcelona afford to buy anyone or anything? Plus all the other news from Spain. There's some interesting Chelsea feedback from yesterday's pod. We'll look ahead to the Carabao Cup semi-finals and the all-new Norwich Corner. All that, and of course your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Lars Sivertsen. Hello and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, Max. How's it going?
Yeah, I'm having a lovely day. Thank you very much. Paul McInnes, same to you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Max. Nice to be here.
And Barry Glendenning. Welcome.
Hello, Max. How are you?
Marvellous. Thank you. Jono says, I'm almost certainly too late, but catching up on yesterday's pod where Barry said something would happen in the Man United Wolves game to make us all forget Arsenal Manchester City. At what point did Barry start worrying that nothing would happen? lots of obvious questions about Manchester United. Ed Woodhouse, not Ed Woodward, says, can you make sure Manchester United get a bit of coverage? A bit worried they might go unnoticed. Barca Jim, excluding my first marriage, has a honeymoon ever come to a more abrupt stop than Rangnick's? And Ellen Bode says, is it possible that Ole took the wheel with him when he left? But let's start with Wolves. And Paul, I thought they deserved this. They were really good in the first half, weren't they?
Yeah, they were excellent in the first half. First of all, I just want to say, I thought that Barca Jim tweet was very funny. It did make me laugh.
Yeah.
And credit where credit's due. It's not really going to come as a great surprise to many people that they played as well as they did, I don't think, because Wolves have been playing from a strong foundation pretty much ever since that first few matches of the season, which they lost, adjusting to Lage and what he wanted to do. It's not entirely dissimilar from the good days under Nuno. You know, the same shape, 3-5-2, sorry, 3-4-3, and same solidity at the back. Change players. Kilman's in instead of Willy Bowley. Bit more energy, I think. Bit more pace, particularly up the flanks. Marcel and obviously Semedo. But they're just very well organised, very well drilled. They know what they're doing. And I think that was, you know, a stark contrast to United. That said, you know, while they're very well organised defensively, they do struggle to score goals. And you could also see why that was in the first half, I thought. And the shot statistics said they had a dozen or so in the first half, but none of them, I think maybe one sort of, there's two in quick succession, including that really great hit from 25 yards from Neves that troubled De Gea. But De Gea's a great keeper. You're going to have to do very well to beat him. So they were solid and they were effective, but they weren't necessarily, United were, you know, reasonably comfortable and contained. And It was a funny change in dynamics in the second half that suddenly the game started to open up and then these chances became possible, and they were possible at both ends. I think, you know, if United had won that game 1-0 themselves, people wouldn't have been scratching their heads going, what happened? They would have gone, oh, that's another sort of characteristic Man United performance.
Do you agree with that, Lars?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a very low-key New Year's resolution, almost not worth mentioning, but I've decided to try to watch more Wolves games because I think just in the first half of the season, they're just one of the teams that just, I don't know.
You know how to live, Lars, don't you?
Yeah. Watch a few more Wolves games, you know, get into fewer arguments on Twitter, the usual stuff. But no, they were very good. And I thought one of the things they did do very well in this game was... we'll get on to Man United's formation, I'm sure, and whether it makes sense or not and all this sort of stuff. But when you're playing this sort of slightly narrow Whether you want to call it a 4-2-2-2 or whether you want to call it a narrow 4-4-2 or whatever you want to call it. One of the potential downsides is that you could get quite exposed on the flanks. And there's a lot of players narrow there. And there's a lot of onus on your fullbacks to provide width going forward. And your fullbacks can be outnumbered at the back. So Wolves making the pitch bigger, trying to play big diagonals into the quick players down the flanks is something Wolves did very well. And if you look at the way that their team is set up, they've got Moutinho and Ruben Neves in the midfield, who are both really good passers of the ball. Connor Cody can ping one as well out to the diagonal. So that's something they've set up very well to do. And I think United didn't really counter it effectively, I guess, until the second half when they changed formation and it became a little bit more even, yeah.
Jan Moutinho, 35 years and 117 days, the oldest player to score a Premier League winner at Manchester United. That's quite old for a footballer, isn't it? Good on him for still struggling away out there.
And this is, again, me being slightly mean and rude to Wolves and wanting to do better. I did catch myself thinking in the second half, when you see Moutinho sort of ping some of those nice passes around that he can, I was thinking, what is he doing at Wolves? You know, he's been a great player and he should be sort of aging gracefully at Fiorentina or somewhere like that. But yeah, he's sort of trudging around for Wolves every week. Like, this seems like a strange thing for João Moutinho to do. But and just like a minute after I thought that, he scored a great winner. And it made me realize I was being very disrespectful to him and the club, and I should try harder. Well done, Wolves.
Well, presumably, given how many games of Wolves you'll watch this year, you may start supporting them, I guess.
Maybe.
I had a chuckle at Moutinho's interview after the game, in which he said he's constantly trying to improve, needs to work on shooting more during games. And I was thinking, if I was João Moutinho, 35 years old as a professional footballer, and I had his sort of back catalogue and greatest hits, I'd really be phoning it in at this stage. working on my game and just coasting along until that big money move to the MLS.
Are you suggesting, Barry, that you feel like you've conquered podcasts and you have no more left to learn? Or are you every day listening back, wondering what you could do better each pod?
Oh, no, I don't think I've conquered anything. That's the thing. So I am constantly trying to improve, and I'm going to have to work for, you know, another 20 years. So I'm not just on the cusp of retirement. But yeah, maybe at some point I might get a lucrative move to some MLS podcast where I just have to talk about the Woodland Timberlakes or whoever. No, that's not even a team, is it?
given that at the end of part two I will read some stinging criticism from an American, the fact that you've come up with the Woodland Timberlakes are a team I would definitely support. Portland Timbers. Anyway, right. Justin Timberlake does not own the Portland Timbers yet, but you never know, he might.
The teams I could have picked, you'd think I would pick one that I actually know the name of. And I haven't seen this stinging criticism from an American listener, but I have a feeling I can guess what it's about.
Okay, well, we'll get to that at the end of part two. Should we talk about Manchester United? That Jamie Jackson said Manchester United appears to be
Before we talk about Manchester United, I know we don't have a huge amount to talk about. I just want to give Wolves some love. I thought Nelson Semedo and Trincao and Daniel Podence were absolutely outstanding, and Manchester United just could not deal with them at all. But what they were doing wasn't really rocket science, and I was slightly baffled by the manner in which Ralf Rangnick didn't really attempt to fix it till half-time.
Charlie says, would it be controversial to suggest Rangnick might need longer than a month to implement his philosophy on this squad? Tim says, what is the plan for United? In the Rangnick era so far, it looks like the burden of creativity is on the centre-backs and McTominay, Matic and Fred to do the actual creating, while four attackers mournfully watch the ball not ending up anywhere near them. Paul, what do you make of Rangnick's first few weeks? I mean, this is his first defeat. That doesn't sound too bad.
No, I mean, I've only watched a couple of the games, but they've been poor in both. On both occasions, they look incredibly disjointed in a way that's almost the inverse to the Oli era. So in the Oli era, they looked like they were going to concede every time they lost possession, which, to be fair to them, you know, they looked reasonably solid under sustained pressure yesterday. But they look, they under Oli, they also look like they could score spectacular goals and overrun teams in periods. And it looked pretty incoherent, and it didn't look like there were the right players playing in the team. I mean, if you're going to play, it looked very much like a 4-2-2-2-2-2-2-2 to me, because there wasn't any width. But you were playing two wide men in the centre of the park. And I thought, well, actually, I say wide men, that really annoys me, because I think Mason Greenwood is the best young striker of his generation, and he should be playing right up top. And I feel like Marcus Rashford's talent is slightly going to waste at United. I feel like Mason Greenwood's talent could go to waste at Man United if he doesn't get the chance to develop in the position he should be playing in.
But I do wonder, Barry, how good is the squad, and where should the squad be? Are they automatically the fourth best squad? Should this squad be challenging higher? Or actually, you know, is it just so imbalanced that you have this centre midfield that isn't that good, that probably wouldn't get, you know, would struggle to necessarily get a game for most of the top six?
On paper, you would probably say yes, they should be challenging for the top four. An awful lot of money has been spent on this squad, but I think it's quite telling that United's two best players last night were both signed by Sir Alex Ferguson, David De Gea and Phil Jones, who I'm sure we'll get to at some point. He has in some quarters been singled out for being responsible for the Wolves goal. I think that's very unfair and lazy criticism of a guy who it's easy to mock and poke fun at. But just, there were so many things wrong last night, but there was no pressing. So, you know, you have this manager who's apparently the godfather of gegenpressing, and that team didn't press. There wasn't any. He said it himself after the game when he was asked about it. Their main tactic in the first half, at least, seemed to be getting the ball to Aaron Wan-Bissaka and getting him to sling crosses into the box. They were all way too high, or they were getting blocked and intercepted. His delivery is pretty poor. I heard Ali McCoist and Darren Bent discussing on TalkSport before I came on that Mason Greenwood was the most lively of United's front four. And that may be true, but it was a very, very low bar. I didn't think he had a particularly good game and wasn't hugely surprised that he was taken off. And the passing up towards the front four, the moves kept breaking down, and it was just, and by the end, United were an incoherent mess. Well, all through the first half. There was 1 5-minute period between, I think, the 65th and 70th minute, when Bruno Fernandes thumped that shot off the bar that he should have buried. Cristiano Ronaldo had the disallowed goal, correctly disallowed. And that United looked, you know, it's like someone had pulled the lever and they finally went, crikey, we better do something here. But Wolves coped admirably apart from those 5 minutes.
And one of the shames, Lars, is Jadon Sancho, who I know you've watched so much in the Bundesliga. There'll be people who don't watch German football who have only seen him in the Premier League and are starting to say, well, he didn't play very well again. And I feel it's sad. And obviously, there's time and he's good enough to turn it around. Of course he is. But just at the moment, it's sad to see him not be as good as he was.
Yeah. And I guess you see flashes here and there with him, and enough flashes that you sort of know the player that's there and that could be there. And I did really think he had kind of turned a corner when he scored against Villarreal, scored against Chelsea. And you thought, all right, here we go. And I thought actually at the time about tweeting something about like the Larry David gif of him, because I'm like, I'm not a Man United fan. So I don't have a lot of skin in the game of Man United being good, but I also really want Jadon Sancho to show what he can do, because we've seen what he can do elsewhere. And but no, he's been very inconsistent. And I say inconsistent, I mean, the output has been consistently not great. But in most games, there'll be a few little moments where he does something really clever, but then there'll be too many moments when he doesn't. I think Ragnik knows very well what he potentially could do and wants to have faith in him. And I think he's one of those players who could thrive in this sort of quite narrow attacking wide role, because he does like to cut inside and come inside, and he's got quite sort of clever feet and all this sort of stuff. But yeah, it's just not really working so far.
Why do you think it is that he hasn't settled?
Okay, so one theory is that he came from a team at Dortmund where they had a very sort of structured attacking game plan where he was told exactly where to run and when to run, and the players around him knew what sort of runs to make to free up space to him, and they knew what kind of passes he wanted. And he's been brought into to Man United and just told to sort of go on and do your thing. I mean, I think there was a line in a Miguel Delaney piece where it was suggested at Man United it's more like go on and express yourself, which isn't really, it's not really that simple. And if Ralf Rangnick can bring some structure and some order to that attack, then theoretically Jadon Sancho should be one of the main beneficiaries of that. But again, it's kind of early doors, and we're not seeing it so far, it's safe to say.
Phil Jones, as you mentioned, Barry, his first game for Manchester United in 707 days. His last appearance was a 6-1 FA Cup win against Tranmere on the 26th of January 2020. The cheer he got for his first quite basic clearance seemed sort of patronising, actually, but he did have a good game. Luke Shaw afterwards said, Phil Jones should be proud of himself. He's been criticised for years. He's gone through a lot, but he's so professional and he was phenomenal. He was exceptional. I'm very happy for him and he deserves it. And I mean, you wrote a piece about him a couple of months ago, didn't you? Sort of saying about this forgotten man, how he's just become a sort of permanent gif. And actually, he's been through the ringer, and to come out and play well, or to even play, is a real achievement.
Yeah, it was a huge night for him, and I was really rooting for him. I didn't want him to have some slapstick Phil Jones moment, you know, where he's skittering along on the ground and trying to head the ball off someone's foot as one of those gifts. He has had such an awful time with injuries. He's become a subject of mockery, figure of ridicule, and just to keep plugging away like that, hugely impressive. And I was glad he got the opportunity and glad he didn't blow it. He was very good. But you could point, you know, a lazy finger of blame at him for the goal, in that he headed the ball straight to the edge of the penalty area rather than to one side. But you could also blame other people, you know, who was blocking Ruben Neves, who was, I think it was Luke Shaw, could have done more in the build-up to the corner that led to the goal. But, yeah, but fair play to him. I mean, I wouldn't imagine we're going to see a renaissance for Phil Jones, and that as soon as other centre-backs are available, he will be left out again. But it must be... I would imagine he was a very happy man going home last night, even though United lost.
A slight change of tack. Ollie says, what's the point of greasing up Adama Traore for just a late second-half substitute appearance? Hardly worth washing him down. Now, if you were in charge of Wolves, would you keep him greasy for the next fixture? I mean, it's probably worth showering, I imagine.
But you mean keeping him greasy throughout, like going about his daily life until Wolves' next play? I don't think that's advisable. I think that'd be very strange behaviour. I mean, they don't play again until the 9th. So that's 5 days of greasy Adama. I mean, that's very strange. That's not going to help him when he goes to the shop or something. People are going to think he's strange. If you go to the shop all greased up like Adama Traore, I think the security man would follow you around. Because he does. Sometimes the security man follows me around. If I wear like my ugly jacket to the shop, then the security man will follow me around, or if I haven't trimmed my beard. I'm almost certain that if I greased up like Adama, the security man would definitely follow me around the shop until I had paid and left.
Well, it's worth an experiment, Lars. Let us know how it goes.
There is talk Adama will possibly leave Wolves during this window. And I mean, he's such a frustrating player. I think he only has 7 Premier League goals to his name in well over, you know, 140, 150 appearances, which is a terrible return. But having the option to send him on when you've got, he's up against Luke Shaw, who's on a yellow card. I think Matic was also on a yellow, and Scott McTominay was on a yellow. it's a good option to have him running at them. And he did, of course, deliver the cross that ultimately led to the goal.
I kind of like the idea of him going to Spurs, because we already have the situation at Spurs where, as someone much cleverer than me tweeted, you know, if there's one man who can fix Spurs, it's Antonio Conte. But if there's one club that can break Antonio Conte, it's Spurs. I mean, if we would then also have that on the playing side, you know, if there's one man who can figure out Adama Traore, then it could be Conte. But if there's one player who even Conte can't figure out, it's Adama Traore. So we'd have these really interesting philosophical arguments colliding at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. It would make sense.
Whereas I'm really hopeful that the other team he's linked to are the one that signed him, West Ham, because I'd love to see him under the tutelage of Moisey, because I think Moisey would burrow straight down to the simplest, most direct way of getting the best out of him. He doesn't. He kind of strips Moisey as a sort of like a, you know, strips off all the excess material from everybody. In fact, you probably see him coming onto the pitch ungreased.
Well, he'd degrease him, wouldn't he?
Yeah, I can imagine he'd degrease him. Literally degrease him.
I think Moyes, being Scottish, would probably batter him. Deep fried Adama. But just sorry, a little correction. Nemanja Matic wasn't on a yellow card when he came on, but Nemanja Matic did bring him down when he was running through on goal and got himself a yellow card.
He did. Right, that'll do for part one. Sid Lowe joins us in just a sec to explain how Barcelona have found some money. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Sid Lowe joins us from Madrid. Hello, Sid.
Good morning, Max. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. How are you? Happy New Year to you and all your ham.
And to you. Thank you very much. My ham is marvellous.
Good. I'm delighted to hear it. Now, every question, I think, pretty much every question we've had on the pod in the last 3 weeks is, how can Barcelona afford Ferran Torres? Where's Barcelona's money? How can they afford anything? So can we cover that first before we talk about Getafe beating Real Madrid and what's happening in the league?
Yeah, there's two things to pick up on here. One is there's a difference between having the money to be able to do it, and the other is being able to fulfil the league's criteria on the salary caps. And the short answer is that Barcelona have the money to do it because of a loan. So they have the money because they have been lent the money to do it. But the second part of the answer is they can't. They currently cannot register Ferran Torres. So they're in a situation in which to be able to register him, and he's going to be injured, and he's now actually tested positive for COVID. So he's going to be injured, I think, for another 2 weeks anyway. So there's a little bit of time, a little bit of manoeuvrability. So essentially, they now need to find themselves in a position where they can fulfil the league's criteria on what's known here as a salary cap. It's essentially their equivalent of the financial fair play. And to do that, of course, people have to leave. But there's a couple of really interesting things that have come out in the last couple of days, which I think tell you something about how fine the line is and how on edge they are, Barcelona. And that is that Xavi, and I'm not sure if he intended to do this, revealed before the weekend's games that the renewal of Dembélé's contract was important to be able to get Ferran Torres in. In other words, Dembélé's new contract, somewhere in the mechanics of that, there was going to be a way of postponing some of his payments or reducing some of his payments in the short term to be able to fulfil that criteria now. And by fulfilling that criteria, you can register Ferran Torres. In other words, put bluntly, Dembélé has him by the bollocks. I mean, he really does. And you know, it looks very much now like he may well not renew his contract with him, in which case they need to find the saving from elsewhere. Now, there's a couple of things here. One is the reason they're not playing Demir, for example, is because if he plays another game, that clicks in a new contract that they can't currently pay. And then the other, of course, is exits. So they would like Luke de Jong to go. They think there's a chance that they can find an exit strategy for Philippe Coutinho, which would make a huge difference. And I think there's one or two others. Obviously, they're still trying on Umtiti. But of course, they've been trying these players for a while now. And, you know, you look at this and lots of people will look at this and say, well, this just proves that the financial fair play makes no difference. Well, actually, no, it proves that it makes a massive difference. Because obviously they would have already registered him. If the financial fair play didn't make a difference, they wouldn't have lost Messi in the summer. They wouldn't have let Griezmann go for free. They wouldn't have sold Luis Suarez for nothing. They wouldn't have sold Ivan Rakitic for 1.5 million. Arturo Vidal wouldn't have gone for nothing. So they've been kind of, if you like, sort of furiously paddling to stay afloat for a while. The other one that looks like it's on the cards now is Alvaro Morata, but that's to do with a loan deal with an option to buy. So it, obviously it's all about pushing things further down the track to fulfill criteria now. Whether that's a good idea, of course, is a totally different question. But the criteria, that's the way that they're trying to fulfill the criteria.
So in a nutshell, Sid, Barcelona being over $1 billion in debt has borrowed some money, which they've immediately spent on a new player who they cannot register yet. That's where we are.
More or less.
Are they completely mad? Aren't they? I mean, is this one of those things that makes more sense from your perspective? It's because it doesn't translate well into the rest of the world, I think.
It doesn't translate well into Lars.
Well, it doesn't translate well into anyone. No, it seems deranged.
No, I mean,
what's the next move? Are they trying to buy Erling Haaland on Klarna? I mean, like, what's going on?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, put in those basic terms, absolutely it doesn't make sense. And you look at it and you think that, you know, the lessons to be learned from what happened before, the wasting of the money on Coutinho and Dembélé, the lessons to be learned there are, don't do this spending. And of course, the other reason to not do the spending is you look at the response from the kids who've come through and been given opportunities because of the crisis, and they've responded brilliantly. So there's a bit of you that thinks, you know what, don't buy anyone. Put some kids in, give them time, give them continuity. Now, that's not going to work with all of them. And as tends to happen with Barcelona, the kids that really impress are all midfielders. And it's not only midfielders that they need, even if Barcelona have a kind of an identity rooted in the midfield and in possession and so on. It makes a little bit more sense, I think, seen from here than it does in those very basic terms. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One of them is that this is a crisis made worse by the pandemic. The other, of course, is that a lot of that financial weight around their shoulders has been shed now with the departure of Messi, with the departure of Luis Suarez, with the departure of Ivan Rakitic. They hope with the departure of Umtiti, possibly, although they don't want him to go, with the departure of Dembélé. So there is going to be some movement there. You've seen players, senior players, Alba, I'm not sure about Alba actually, I think so, Piqué and Sergio Busquets have taken fairly significant pay cuts. Sergio Roberto, I think, probably will end up going. So there are cuts being made. And then, of course, the other thing is we're coming out of the pandemic in theory, although it looks like we're now going back into it. So the ability to generate is growing again. So I think some of those issues have actually been addressed, even if in the short term right now, it kind of doesn't look like it. And as I say, there's these two things going on in parallel. One is the basic financial state of the club, which lots of clubs have very big debts. And the other is, can you get through the criteria right now? Also, the other thing to say, as you say, they borrow the money and immediately spent it all. Well, they borrowed a lot of money and immediately spent some of it. And the terms of the deal on Ferran Torres look like they're actually reasonably favourable. It actually looks like City have sort of done Barcelona a bit of a favour. I don't know whether I should bore you with the mechanics of the financial fair play a little bit. The salary cap that you get told about with Barcelona, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think is 93 million euros. It might be 97. I can't remember. So it's very, very low. It's way down the table of the salary caps in La Liga.
Over here, Sid, it's constantly compared to Watford's.
Right, but that's about right. Okay, so now that is not the amount you are spending on salaries. That's the amount you are allowed to spend on salaries. So, of course, the reality is that they're spending something, I can't remember what the figure is now, something like 350 or 400 million euros on salaries, but they're allowed to spend 90. Now, that means, obviously, at that point, essentially there's an automated system. You try and register a player, you press the button and computer says no. Right now, the way you can get out of that because of the pandemic is La Liga's introduced what's known as the 4-for-1 rule. And essentially what that means is if we can see that you are making significant strides to improve your financial situation, we will not absolutely and completely block you from signing people. But we will only allow you to sign and invest at a rate of 1 euro for every 4 euros you're saving. So in other words, it's not enough to say a player that's earning 1 million leaves so we can put a player that's earning 1 million in. No, to put a player that's earning 1 million in, you need a player that's earning 4 million to leave. And that's a way of saying, yes, you are still above your salary cap, but we can see the effort being made to break it. We can see the direction is the right one. And of course, that's salary cap for now. That salary cap can shift over the summer as income comes in and so on. So a lot of this is about playing with time and playing with where they are right now. And obviously, one of the other ones, I didn't mention, of course, which makes a little bit of a difference, is the departure of Sergio Aguero, because of course you save on his salary as well.
much like the Jay Rodriguez, where we're never quite sure where he is, I did a double take this morning when I saw Sky Sports. Ferran Torres walking out to do his introductory keepy-uppies. I missed that transfer completely. Why did City sell him? Or was he agitating for a move? I that passed me by completely, I must confess.
Ferran said something yesterday that I thought was quite interesting. And he said that his career plan always involved a return to Spain. Not yet, but it always did. And so I think this is a move that's been basically instigated by his desire to come back for whatever reason. And obviously, as Guardiola himself has said, hasn't he, that this is about if a player wants to go, there's no point in trying to force him to stay. You then try and find a deal that's relatively beneficial for everybody.
Two quick things, really. And you were talking about how the Torres deal was favourable to Barcelona, because from over here, it looks like it's favourable to City. They sort of doubled their transfer fee. I'd like to know a little bit more about that. And I'm just wondering if there's a little bit of this which is also political, where they need to have somebody coming in, they need to have a signing that makes them look like they're moving forward.
Of course they do. And I don't know if you heard it yesterday, Joan Laporta, who's very pugnacious and kind of bullish at the best of times, yesterday basically said, "We're back, baby."
Yeah, exactly.
He kind of said, everyone has to wait, you know, everyone has to be ready because Barca are back. And of course you have this sort of slight contradiction, because you have Laporta, and I think actually people quite like the fact that he's bullish, and that's sort of part of his charm. And then you've got Matteo Alemany, who's the, I was going to call him the CEO, but I think his official title is Director of Football, who's an eminently sensible man. And so when you see Laporta kind of go really bullish, and you think, oh my God. But then you see Alemany, and you think, well, the person who's actually organising this...
It's like Boris and Chris Whitty, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I would be reluctant to ever compare anyone to Boris. I think that would be deeply unfair. So it's, you sort of think, well, look, there is definitely a plan. There is definitely a strategy in place. This is not just wildly throwing money at things and saying we're going to buy everyone. But of course, keeping that idea of excitement alive is partly what Laporta does. And so you're right. There's definitely a degree of political pressure there. There's a degree of keeping fans happy and saying, look, we're dealing with this. And I actually think Ferran Torres is a signing that people are really quite optimistic about. In terms of the deal is very simple, as you say, that the figures look reasonably high, but this is a player, of course, who played very well for Spain. And I think there is a sense that actually this is someone who could be a big part of the next generation of the Spanish national team. And the deal is good for Barcelona simply in terms of the way it's structured, in terms of when they're forced to pay. And that's almost all being pushed down the line. As far as I know, Barcelona are paying almost nothing right now.
Looking on the pitch, Barcelona actually, you know, given the crisis that they're in, I mean, that race for the top four is really interesting. What, they're 1 point behind Atleti, who are in fourth, you know, Betis a point ahead of them. And actually, you could go down quite a long way to teams that could possibly think that at the moment a good run and they'd have a good shot, almost down to Espanyol in 11th, even if that seems ridiculous.
Yeah, I think Espanyol might be a step too far, but you're right, it goes a long way down. You look at the table and you look at Valencia and Villarreal, for example, and you think it's not impossible that they get into that fight. As you say, I mean, in a way, Barcelona are the definition of how open it is. This is a team that's been a complete basket case in theory, and it's actually pretty close. Obviously, that tells you something about the fact that Madrid, and to a slightly lesser extent Sevilla, because Sevilla could really put themselves right up behind Madrid if they win their game in hand. Those two teams are a big step ahead of everyone else at the moment. Atletico are in there, despite having lost four in a row. First time that's ever happened with Simeone. And I'm reluctant to say to go too far down this route. But of course, in part, it's open because of the paucity of the candidates. But these aren't terrible teams. Or at least in theory, they're not supposed to be terrible teams. I think if you look at it at the moment and the way teams are playing, you would look at Villarreal and think they're the team that you can really see putting together a bit of a run now.
Getafe beat Real Madrid. Yeah. They started the season with seven defeats, Real Madrid. And they're out of the relegation zone and taking inspiration from Crystal Palace.
Yeah, I love this. I mean, of all the places, you know, to take inspiration from Crystal Palace, after seven games, seven defeats, they were thinking no one in Spain had ever started a season that badly. So you thought, that's it, they're done. And of course, they looked around and they discovered that not so long ago, was it 2017-18? I mean, you lot will know much more about that Palace team than me. And I must admit, yesterday, I had to go and look up the squad to remind myself who was in it so that I could make lots of smart-ass references to it. They discovered that Palace had been in this situation even worse and that they'd got out of it. So why can't we? And well, they're out of it now. With Michel, the manager, they lost the first seven games and drew the eighth. So it's, what's that, 1 point from 24. Since Kike Sanchez-Flores has taken over, who'd of course been unemployed since he left Watford, Kike Sanchez-Flores took over 16 years after his first spell at Getafe, comes in, and they've now picked up, I think it's 17 of 33 points, a league table based only on the results since Kike Sanchez-Flores took over, would put Getafe fifth. So they're flying, they're out of the relegation zone.
If I was Getafe, I wouldn't get too loud about how well Kike Sanchez-Flores is doing, considering how badly Ranieri's doing at Watford, because he could quite possibly be back there any time.
Yeah.
You never know when Kike Sanchez-Flores is appearing at Watford's training ground again. Finally, Sid, Kieran Trippier going from Atleti to Newcastle, which seems to be happening now. You were saying he was applauding the fans at the last game. It seems a strange transfer on the face of it.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Newcastle fans, forgive me for saying this, but put in very blunt terms, this is a guy leaving a club that's in the Champions League, who plays basically every game, although at the start of the season it didn't look like this was going to be the case, but plays basically every game when he's fit, who was a league champion last year, going to a club that's in a relegation fight that may well go down. Obviously, look, there are other elements to this. There are elements we don't know, for example, about whether, you know, who knows if there's a family element to this. Certainly, I think there was a slight cooling of the relationship last year at Atletico, but certainly he keeps playing and Simeone said he wants him to stay and he thinks he's a brilliant player. Obviously, of course, the financial offer will be huge and you know, that's understandable. I think Trippier's 31, so it would be perhaps a last chance of a really, really big contract. As well, I think that something had shifted by the fact that in the summer, Trippier was interested in that move to Manchester United and it didn't happen and Atletico blocked it. And now, of course, I suppose from Atletico's point of view, it's a case of, well, do Newcastle come, or maybe another club, but I suspect Newcastle, do Newcastle come with enough money that we think, well, actually, we take this. But speaking to people at the club at the weekend, you know, their view on this is very much, poof, you lose basically your only real right back. I mean, you've got Vasalico, but you're absolutely your first choice right back halfway through the season at a time when maybe you can't react and get someone else in. And a player who, and I feel like I should say this because I don't know if this gets talked about in England, you tell me, but Kieran Trippier has been bloody brilliant for Atletico Madrid. He's a really, really good footballer, really bright. Every decision is the right one. Technically very good, defended really, really well in a structure, obviously, that puts a priority on that. As I say, won a league title. This isn't a player going to Spain and winning a league title. It's a player going to Spain and winning a league title with a team who, in theory, shouldn't win the league. I think he's been absolutely brilliant. And look, purely selfishly, I'm really disappointed that it looks very much like he's going.
Sid, thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Sid Lowe there, out in Madrid. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll begin with a bit of chat around Chelsea. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So let's do a bit of Chelsea before we get on to the interesting feedback that Barry will guess. Thiago Silva signed on for next season, 2022-23. That is next season. Yes, it is. To play here with Chelsea is a real pleasure. He told the club's website, never thought I'd play for 3 years here in this great club. I'm very happy to stay for another season. He's been, Lars, a sort of revelation, hasn't he? I mean, I guess we shouldn't be surprised, but occasionally, you know, foreign centre-backs come here and we think, oh, they won't be able to cut it. But he has been really sort of incredibly smooth about the whole thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's ever a doubt of the quality, but maybe the age. I mean, he's one of those, he's 37, but you watch him play, he doesn't move like a guy who's 37. He must have looked after himself very, very well. And just like, I know it's a small thing, but the leap on the fella on attacking set pieces in particular, because he's not actually that tall for a centre half. But no, he's been absolutely brilliant for them. And I think the sort of 4-3-3 system suits him very well as well, because it doesn't expose him one-on-one that often. And when it does, he seems to handle it very well. So it's very good.
Paul, you wanted to talk about John Terry's non-fungible tokens. Didn't you? I don't know in any detail if you wanted to or not.
I would like to stick up for Paul here and say that in his defence, I don't think he particularly wanted to talk about John Terry's non-fungible tokens, but suggested he would be willing to if we were stuck for things to talk about because there was only one game last night. Is that more a correct assessment of the situation, Paul?
Absolutely, Barry, and I thank you wholeheartedly for your words. I just think it's there's obviously a bigger conversation about NFTs, which in my opinion are a scam. You know, I find it funny there's even a debate about whether they are or that they're not. But there's obviously a bigger sort of conversation to be had about that, and I hear whispers that the pod will be addressing it in depth. And Max, you've written a very enlightening and informative article already on the subject. I just thought there was something comic also, and it's maybe only in a minor key, that, you know, John Terry appears on Twitter, you know, and within, you know, 6 weeks he's hawking monkeys left, right and center, including these apes. So he buys these apes, which are very popular NFTs, but he's also changed his icon on Twitter to a child ape. Baby ape, okay, in a Chelsea kit, who's part not of the bored ape but of a different set of apes called Ape Kids Club.
Right.
Now, Ape Kids Club only cost you £4,000 for a JPEG that you don't actually own. You only own a link to a place on the website, which can easily be moved onto another website should somebody choose. But the depth to which John Terry, a man whose reputation is not consistent, a reputation off the pitch is not consistent with that on the pitch, sort of just goes two-footed into these things.
Well, we are going to do a pod on crypto and fan tokens and NFTs, as you can imagine. I mean, I can't speak for anyone else. None of us know what they are, including me, who wrote 1,000 words on it a few months ago. As Lars read it and said, I know even less than I did before I started. The intention...
I said in our chat, if this was going to be a thing, because I haven't really like fully educated myself on the NFTs, my sense is that they're also almost definitely a scam, but I don't, you know, so I offered to educate myself if this was going to be a subject today, and you sent a link to your article, which I have to say was not, I mean, that was, I knew those things already. When I said that wasn't the in-depth research I was looking for.
But did you enjoy reading the article?
I mean, not really, because I kind of wanted to go to sleep.
Okay.
I mean,
Oh, well, there you are. That's all the review I wanted. I was just trying to fill a page with something mildly entertaining. But I'm happy to
I do like some of your articles.
That's very kind. I'll take some. I welcome all feedback. Now, speaking of feedback, Barry, you want to guess what we got in trouble for?
I am going to go out on a limb and say that an American listener has complained that we consistently don't give Christian Pulisic the credit he deserves.
Absolutely spot on. Let me read you from below the line.
Now, I think we've heard, we might, if it's who I think it might be, I suspect we may have heard from him or her before, but carry on.
Possibly. So this is, John Bruin alerted me to this. The pod has managed it again. You told the story of a Chelsea match while completely eliminating the American player's contribution to the proceedings. He scored a goal. Every other goal was mentioned except that one. This is the third time that this has happened. I brought this up another time after the match during Pulisic's first season, when he came off the bench, beat three Liverpool players to set up one goal, and then scored a goal and almost single-handedly made the match a contest. He was not mentioned in your account of the match. How is that possible? I have lived in England. I did some of my college in Nottingham. I lived in London and Oxford and Cambridge. I also played football in England at a fairly high level. I know this very one thing very clearly. British football culture is quite insular and specifically anti-American to a degree that is really quite obvious from the outside, but strangely invisible to Brits themselves. And Americans are almost wholly unaware of it, which is a real problem, which makes it seem like the Brits are unaware of it, and no one is aware of it. Anyway, like, I don't want to critique the critique until I've finished it. Considering that some of our top players are now turning up at your clubs, we get it. You don't particularly welcome a future where Americans are good at football. The horrendous abuse of US Women's World Cup winners in France 2 years ago certainly told the story. Millie Bright executes a leg-breaking revenge tackle on Alex Morgan in the 80th minute of the match, and all the tabloid press wants to talk about is those annoying Americans with their confidence and their celebrations. It was appalling. I would warn all American players against signing with Premier League clubs. We haven't seen any problems with Reina at Dortmund, McKennie at Juve, Adams at Leipzig, Ware at Lille. We follow the development of our players quite closely, and we don't generally get the sense that any form of prejudice is making them feel as if they're fighting through some invisible barrier that prevents them simply being respected as players. But Pulisic at Chelsea has really been quite awful. The abuse from fans has been extraordinary. I think we would all like him to leave Chelsea and also England for exactly this reason. People will not credit the good work he's done, and he will be the first targeted for abuse when his form declines. He seems tremendously discouraged at Stamford Bridge, and I suspect this is at least partly the reason for it. So we welcome all feedback. We have many, many listeners in the United States, so it is possible that this is true because I don't believe it and I don't see it. And I actually wrote in the script yesterday, I went back into yesterday's script and I'd written the words, and Christian Pulisic, that finish looked so good. But I don't know, Barney was going off on one or something and I didn't get round to say, if only I'd got round to saying it. But I don't believe that we have an anti-American agenda. I certainly have no, I'm completely indifferent. If America, if the US are brilliant at football, I don't, that's great. I mean, this is what I think. I don't, obviously, subconsciously,
I
maybe.
I have a feeling that criticism is rooted specifically in some lame gag or other we once cracked about Christian Pulisic being left off to training by his mum, or his, sorry, his mom in an SUV every day. And that particularly incensed that particular listener. I must confess, I have no strong feelings one way or towards or the other towards Christian Pulisic. I think he's a good player. He's struggled to force his way into the Chelsea team and get a good run of games. But there is no more ardent supporter of the likes of Landon Donovan, Tony Meola and Alexi Lalas than I. And I
don't know if you're helping, Barry.
I like the idea of this this listener sort of warning very good American players that you mustn't go to the Premier League because if you do, your goals might not get mentioned on podcasts. This is the kind of horror, this is the glass ceiling you face in this league where you'll be unfathomably well paid to compete in, you know, the biggest, one of the biggest stages in club football. But, you know, if you are American, there's a possibility your goals will not get mentioned on the podcast. I mean, that could make anyone go to La Liga, I think, or to the Bundesliga, because I'm sure their podcasts are much more friendly to the Americans. I'm sorry, I just thought that was a slightly unhinged bit of feedback. I think Paul McGinnis is even wearing a Portland Timbers cap. This is a very US friendly.
Well, if the fact that Paul's wearing a,
I would like to say how can English football have an insular attitude towards American football when Norwich City paid £10 million for Josh Sargent?
What I want to know is how can
that joke doesn't that's not helping, Paul. That's
how can Paul be wearing a Portland Timbers hat? Literally, it's only one of the three things that Barry can see right now. Yet 40 minutes ago, he called them the Woodland Timberlakers. but listen, a genuine.
I was disappointed because if he wanted a comedy. American soccer. I mean, there's so many, like the Kalamazoo Outrage was a team that existed, not in the MLS, mind you. They were in a division below, but you know, the Tampa Bay Mutiny. You don't have to make
Dallas
them up. They exist.
And I would also argue that Gio Reyna is not American. He is from Sunderland, which is where he was born and spent his formative years.
Well, I make a serious point, which is we have loads of American listeners. We value you as listeners. If you really believe that we are in some way, I don't know why you're listening to us if that is the case, that we're consistently anti-American. But I also, so please get in touch, you know, footballweekly at theguardian.com. You can tweet us, you know where we are. We welcome all these.
I think we've rectified the situation in the past 4 minutes.
But also now, I'm incredibly self-conscious. I feel like I'll just be watching Christian Pulisic the whole time. I'll be watching nothing else. And like, if he does anything, and I'll just feel such incredible pressure. Suddenly, like half the podcast for the rest of the season will be about Christian Pulisic. I won't touch on other issues and other things that happen. Anyway.
Maybe we should have a week, every at least one of the three podcasts, there should be a section dedicated to what has the Americans been up to this week. just in case there's something we haven't addressed.
Yeah, it's true. Look, by all means,
that might be a thing.
If you're a listener in Australia and you feel the same, or you know, we have a big following in Malawi now, etc., etc., let us know, because we are a podcast.
The anti-Malawi agenda is real, though, to be fair.
It's real. You're right.
We've had a big meeting about this, Max.
You're right. Don't tell them. But look, do get in touch, as we'd like to hear from you. You know, Carabao Cup semi-finals this week, annoyingly on Wednesday and Thursday, not Tuesday and Wednesday like they should be. So we'll only review Chelsea Spurs on Thursday, and Arsenal Liverpool will have to wait until Monday, along with the FA Cup third round games. But Paul, out of those, Chelsea Spurs, Arsenal Liverpool, give us a final prediction.
It's a good. I mean, I think I would say, well, let's say North London derby, because I think you know that the Spurs are maybe sort of they're not scoring goals for fun, but they're being pretty consistent, and there's a certain element of inconsistency here. But Chelsea at the minute, and they might be hurting a little bit, and I would imagine Liverpool will play a team that is not entirely familiar, whereas I think Arsenal might see this as a good chance to have some more silverware. So let's say, yeah, a North London derby final would be a good one for all neutrals.
It would be.
I'll go for that.
I just can't face seeing Harry Kane looking bereft, picking up another loser's medal at the hands of Arsenal. God, that's going
to... Oh. Yeah, but I think if Conte gets to a final, Conte wins the final. That's what I think.
Right, okay. Another question for you, actually, Paul. Mark says, as an equally embarrassed Norwich fan, can Paul see any hope? And does he, like me, blame abysmal recruitment for our current humiliation? Compare us to Brentford, for instance. Equal budgets, higher ambition, etc.
No, I can't see any hope for us, I'm afraid. I think it's there's not enough. For the simple fact of the matter, there's not enough other teams in the pot now. It's really only Watford can be dragged in. And it's going to be very hard, and we've lost all our form again. I think they should have gamed the COVID system more than they did. I'm pretty sure we shouldn't have played our game against Villa, and we got tonked, and I think that knocked a lot of stuffing out of us. And I have to sort of agree about the recruitment. It's not looked good at all, because we're buying young, callow players who aren't ready for the Premier League, partly because we need to buy players young so that we can get a return on the investment later, because that's our model.
Can I ask, Paul, do you have any insight into what's going on regarding Todd Cantwell, who I was hugely impressed by last time Norwich were in the Premier League, but he's not getting in the side, is he? Or he was in and then out again, and has he fallen out? Or does he want away?
I know a little, and I wouldn't want to sort of go too far into details. I think some of it is personal. But I think it then becomes more complicated than that, you know, as the season goes on and you don't play. I think he has picked up injuries. According to the club, he has had COVID. So, you know, various different complicating factors. But it's looking like it's going to, you know, I've seen it reported around that, you know, they're looking to shift him actively this window in order to try and generate some money. And I think that will be a sad end because... You know, he is one of our own. You know, we've got a very good academy and we've developed a lot of talent, but he's the only one from Norfolk.
At the risk of turning this into sort of Norwich Corner, I'm really curious about your take.
I think that ship has sailed, Lars, to be honest.
The general vibe of Norwich fans when it comes to Stuart Webber, your esteemed sporting director, who has, you know, been a sort of rising star. You know, who put together the Huddersfield team that got promoted on no money, who put together the Norwich team that initially got promoted very cheaply. This summer's sort of shopping spree, maybe sort of the first time in his sort of career as a sporting director that I can tell where things maybe haven't quite gone to plan and some money has been spent in a way that they don't, I mean, it doesn't seem to be working out very well.
If you looked at, he's bought a lot of players and quite a few of them have been misses. There's a guy who, you know, we bought a guy called Melvin City, who was one of our first attempts at buying a defensive midfielder in the position we've lacked for years. And he never played for the club and was, you know, had his contract cancelled by mutual consent in the summers. And, you know, it's quite, I mean, we didn't spend a lot of money on him, but we bought a lot of players. and probably about a third of them have worked. A third of them have been okay, and a third of them have failed. So, you know, and I think he's always been quite upfront about the fact that there's the prospects of that happening. Listen, Stuart Webber has been a fantastic success for Norwich City. There's no doubt about it. Our fans, when they moan, and they moan on Twitter, and that's where moaners hang out, you know, these people, they fail to kind of properly recognise the successes we have had. You know, there's no, for us to be a yo-yo club like they are, we've got no divine right to even be that. So we've had some excellent seasons in the Championship, and, you know, we've not got it right in the Premier League. I think that's admittable. But I think, you know, the thing that Brentford did, they were pragmatic and we were not pragmatic. And I do think that there is something that Stuart Webber can probably learn. And I think he would say that, you know, he's only 36 or 37. He's not been in the game very, you know, he's got a lot of room still to learn. I think we could have had more pragmatism. And I think Dean Smith is a manager who's going to bring more pragmatism to the team and to the running of the club. And the club likes having long-term relationships with managers. I think Dean Smith wants to be there for a long time. So I think if he is there, I think that we'll move more in that direction, and I think we need to. But no, Stuart Webber's been a massive success for Norwich. Delia Smith's a great owner. Daniel Fark was a legendary manager, and I won't have anybody else say otherwise.
Thanks so much for joining us here on Norwich Corner. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
Like Alan Partridge, Max, I am looking forward to the pedestrianisation of Norwich Corner.
Let's see what we can do. Let's finish with this. Al7 says, "Hi, Max. It's my birthday in a minute. I'm not important, but James Milner is, and it's his birthday too. If you could wish him a happy birthday on the pod, I will share in the receipt of your goodwill and enjoy the day all the more. Thanks. Barry, could you wish Al7 and James Milner a happy birthday?"
I wish both of them, Al and Millie, a very, very happy birthday.
Thank you so much. And thanks for coming on today, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
We're back on Thursday.
This is The Guardian.